It's Uncle Al. A makeshift garret is tightened around his blackened neck. Later that night, Marlena and I sneak into the menagerie and bring Bobo back to our stateroom. In for a penny, in for a pound.
Chapter 24.
So this is what it boils down to, is it? Sitting alone in the lobby waiting for family that's not going to come? I can't believe Simon forgot. Especially today. Especially Simon. That boy spent the first 7 years of his life on the Ringling Show. To be fair, I suppose the boy is 71. Or is that 69? Damn it, I'm tired of not knowing. When Rosemary comes back, I'll ask her what year it is and settle the matter once and for all. She's very kind to me, that Rosemary. She won't make me feel foolish, even if I am. A man ought to know how old he is. I remember so many things as clear as a bell. Like the day of Simon's birth. God, such joy, such relief. The vertigo as I approached the bed, the trepidation. And there was my angel, my Marlena, smiling up at me, tired, radiant, with a blanketed bundle nestled in the crook of her arm. His face was so dark and scrunched, he hardly looked like a person at all. But then, when Marlena pulled the blanket back from his hair, and I saw that it was red, I thought I might actually faint from joy. I never really doubted, not really, and I would have loved and raised him anyway, but still. I damn near dropped over when I saw that red hair. I glance at the clock, antsy with despair. A speck is over for sure. Oh, it's just not fair. All those decrepit old people who won't even know what they're looking at. And here's me, trapped in this lobby. Or am I? I furrow my brow and blink. What exactly makes me think I'm trapped? I glance from side to side. No one. I turn and look toward the hall. A nurse whizzes past, clutching a chart, and looking at her shoes. I scooch to the edge of my seat and reach for my walker. By my estimation, I'm only 18 feet from freedom. Well, there's an entire city block to traverse after that, but if I hoof it, I bet I can catch the last few acts. And the finale. It won't make up for missing a speck, but it's something. A warm glow tingles through me, and I snort back a giggle. I may be in my 90s, but who says I'm helpless? The glass door slides open as I approach. Thank God for that. I don't think I could manage the walker on a regular door. No, I'm wobbly, all right. But that's okay. I can work with wobbly. I reach the sidewalk and stop, blinded by the sun. I've been away from the real world for so long that the combination of engines running, dogs barking, and horns honking brings a lump to my throat. The people on the sidewalk part and pass me like I'm a stone in a stream. Nobody seems to think it odd that an old man is standing in his slippers on the sidewalk right outside an old folks' home. But it occurs to me that I'm still in plain sight if one of the nurses comes into the lobby. I lift my walker, twist it a couple of inches to the left, and plunk it down again. Its plastic wheels scrape the concrete, and the sound makes me giddy. It's a real noise, a gritty noise, not the squeak or patter of rubber. I shuffle around behind it, savoring the way my slippers scuffle. Two more manipulations like that, and I'm facing the right way. A perfect 3-point turn. I grab hold and shuffle off, concentrating on my feet. I mustn't go too fast. Falling would be disastrous in so many ways. There are no floor tiles, so I measure my progress in feet. My feet. Each time I take a step, I bring the heel of one foot parallel to the toes of the other. And so it goes, 10 inches at a time. I stop occasionally to gauge my progress. It's slow but steady. The magenta and white tint is a little bigger each time I look up. It takes me half an hour, and I have to stop twice. But I'm practically there and already feeling the thrill of victory. I'm huffing a little, but my legs are still steady. There was that one woman I thought might make trouble, but I managed to get rid of her. I'm not proud of it. I don't normally speak to people in that manner, and especially women, but damned if I was going to let some busybody do-gooder foil my outing. I'm not setting foot in that facility again until I've seen what's left of the show, and woe to the person who tries to make me. Even if the nurses catch up with me right now, I'll make a scene. I'll make noise. I'll embarrass them in public and make them fetch Rosemary. When she realizes how determined I am, she'll take me to the show. Even if she misses the rest of her shift, she'll take me. It is her last shift after all. Oh, Lord, how am I going to survive that place when she's gone? The remembrance of her imminent departure racks my old body with grief, but it's quickly displaced by joy. I am now close enough to hear the music thumping from the big top. Oh, the sweet, sweet sound of circus music. I lodge my tongue in the corner of my mouth and hurry. I'm almost there now, just a few yards further. Yo, Gramps, where do you think you're going? I stop, startled. I look up. A kid sits behind the ticket wicket, his face framed by bags of pink and blue cotton candy. Flashing toys blink from the glass counter under his arms. There's a ring through his eyebrow, a stud through his bottom lip, a large tattoo on each shoulder. His hands are tipped with black nails. Where does it look like I'm going? I say querulously. I don't have time for this. I've missed enough of the show as it is. Tickets are $12. I don't have any money. Then you can't go in. I am flabbergasted, still struggling for words, when a man comes up beside me. He's older, clean-shaven, well-dressed. The manager, I'm willing to bet. What's going on here, Russ? The kid jerks his thumb at me. I caught this old guy trying to sneak in. Sneak! I exclaim in righteous indignation. The man takes one look at me and turns back to the kid. What the hell is the matter with you? Russ scowls and looks down. The manager stands in front of me, smiling graciously. Sir, I'd be happy to show you in. Would it be easier if you had a wheelchair? Then we wouldn't have to worry about finding you a good seat. That would be nice. Thank you, I say, ready to weep with relief. My altercation with Russ left me shaking. The idea that I could make it this far, only to be turned away by a teenager with a pierced lip, was horrifying. But all is okay. Not only have I made it, but I think maybe I'm going to get a ringside seat. The manager goes around the side of the big top and returns with a standard hospital-issue wheelchair. I let him help me into it, and then relax my aching muscles as he pushes me toward the entrance. Don't mind Russ, he says. He's a good kid underneath all those holes, although it's a wonder he doesn't spring a leak when he drinks. In my day, they put the old fellows in the ticket booth. Kind of the end of the road. You were on a show? The man asks. Which one? I was on two. The first was the Benzini Brothers' Most Spectacular Show on Earth, I say proudly, rolling each syllable off my tongue. The second was Ringling. The chair stops. The man's face suddenly appears in front of mine. You were with the Benzini Brothers? What years? The summer of 1931. You were there for the stampede? Sure was, I exclaim. Hell, I was in the thick of it, in the menagerie itself. I was the show's vet. He stares at me, incredulous. I don't believe this. After the Hartford fire and Hagenbeck-Wallace wreck, that's probably the most famous circus disaster of all time. It was something, all right. I remember it like yesterday. Hell, I remember it better than yesterday. The man blinks and sticks his hand out. Charlie O'Brien III. Jacob Jankowski, I say, taking his hand. The first. Charlie O'Brien stares at me for a very long time, his hand spread on his chest as though he were pledging an oath. Mr. Jankowski, I'm going to get you into the show now before there's nothing left to see, but it would be an honor and a privilege if you would join me for a drink in my trailer after the show. You're a living piece of history, and I'd surely love to hear about that collapse firsthand. I'd be happy to see you home afterward. I'd be delighted, I say. He snaps to and moves around to the back of the chair. All righty, then. I hope you enjoy our show. An honor and a privilege. I smile serenely as he wheels me right up to the ring curb.
Chapter 25.
It's after the show. A damn good show, too. Although not of the magnitude of either the Benzini Brothers or Ringling. But how could it be? For that, you need a train. I'm sitting at a Formica table in the back of an impressively appointed RV, sipping an equally impressive single malt, Lafroig, if I'm not mistaken, and singing like a canary. I tell Charlie everything about my parents, my affair with Marlena, and the deaths of Kemmel and Walter. I tell him about crawling across the train in the night with a knife in my teeth and murder on my mind. I tell him about the red-lighted men and the stampede and about Uncle Al being strangled. And finally, I tell him what Rosie did. I don't even think about it. I just open my mouth and the words tumble out. The relief is instant and palpable. All these years it's been pent up inside me. I thought I'd feel guilty, like I betrayed her. But what I feel, particularly in light of Charlie's sympathetic nodding, is more like absolution, redemption even. I was never entirely sure whether Marlena knew. There was so much going on in the menagerie at that moment that I have no idea what she saw. And I never brought it up. I couldn't, because I couldn't risk changing how she felt about Rosie. Or, if it comes right down to it, how she felt about me. Rosie may have been the one who killed August, but I also wanted him dead. At first, I stayed silent, to protect Rosie. And there was no question she needed protecting. In those days, elephant executions were not uncommon, but there was never any excuse for keeping it from Marlena, even if it caused her to harden toward Rosie. She'd never have caused her harm. In the entire history of our marriage, it was the only secret I kept from her, and eventually it became impossible to fix. With a secret like that, at some point the secret itself becomes irrelevant. The fact that you kept it does not. Having heard my story, Charlie looks not in the least bit shocked or judgmental, and my relief is so great that when I finish telling him about the stampede, I keep going. I tell him about our years with Ringling and how we left after the birth of our third child. Marlena had simply had enough of being on the road. Kind of a nesting thing, I figure. And besides, Rosie was getting on in years. Fortunately, the staff veterinarian at Brookfield Zoo in Chicago chose that spring to drop dead, and I was a shoo-in. Not only did I have 7 years of experience with exotics and a damn good degree, but I also came with an elephant. We bought a rural property far enough from the zoo that we could keep the horses, but close enough that the drive to work wasn't that bad. The horses more or less retired, although Marlena and the kids still rode them occasionally. They grew fat and happy, the horses, not the children or Marlena for that matter. Bobo came with us, of course. He got into more trouble over the years than all the kids put together, but we loved him just the same. Those were the salad days, the halcyon years, the sleepless nights, the wailing babies, the days the interior of the house looked like it had been hit by a hurricane, the times I had 5 kids, a chimpanzee, and a wife in bed with fever. Even when the 4th glass of milk got spilled in a single night, or the shrill screeching threatened to split my skull, or when I was bailing out some son or other, or in one memorable instance, Bobo, from a minor predicament at the police station. They were good years, grand years. But it all zipped by. 1 minute Marlena and I were in it up to our eyeballs, and next thing we knew, the kids were borrowing the car and fleeing the coop for college. And now, here I am, in my 90s and alone. Charlie, bless his heart, is actually interested in my story. He picks up the bottle and leans forward. As I push my glass toward him, there's a knock on the door. I yank my hand back as though it's been singed. Charlie slides off the bench and leans toward a window, pulling the plaid curtain back with 2 fingers. Shit, he says. It's the heat. I wonder what's up. They're here for me. He glances at me, hard and precise. What? They're here for me, I say, trying to keep my eyes level with his. It's hard. I have nystagmus, the result of a long-ago concussion. The harder I try to look steadily at someone, the more my eyes jerk back and forth. Charlie lets the curtain fall and goes to the door. Good evening, says a deep voice from the doorway. I'm looking for a Charlie O'Brien. Someone said I could find him here. You can and did. What can I do for you, officer? I was hoping you could help us out. An elderly man went missing from a nursing home just down the street. The staff seems to think he probably came here. Wouldn't be surprised. Folks of all ages enjoy the circus. Sure, of course. Thing is, this guy is 93 and pretty frail. They were hoping he'd come back on his own after the show, but it's been a couple of hours, and he still hasn't showed up. I'm mighty worried about him. Charlie blinks pleasantly at the cop. Even if he did come here, I doubt he's still around. We're fixing to leave real soon. Do you remember seeing anyone fitting that description tonight? Sure. Lots, all sorts of families brought their old folks. How about an old man on his own? I didn't notice, but then again we get so many people coming through, I kind of tune out after a while. The cop pokes his head inside the trailer. His eyes light on me with obvious interest. Who's that? Who, him? Says Charlie, waving in my direction. Yes, That's my dad. Do you mind if I come in for a moment? After just the slightest pause, Charlie steps aside. Sure, be my guest. The cop climbs inside the trailer. He's so tall he has to stoop. He has a jutting chin and fiercely hooked nose. His eyes are set too close together, like an orangutan's. How are you doing, sir? He asks, coming closer. He squints, examining me closely. Charlie shoots me a look. Dad can't talk. He had a major stroke a few years ago. Wouldn't he be better off staying at home? Said the officer. This is home. I drop my jaw and let it quaver. I reach for my glass with a trembling hand and nearly knock it over. Nearly because it would be a shame to waste such good scotch. Here, Pops, let me help you, says Charlie, rushing over. He slides onto the bench beside me and reaches for my glass. He lifts it to my lips. I point my tongue like a parrot's, letting it touch the ice cubes that tumble toward my mouth. The cop watches. I'm not looking directly at him, but I can see him in my peripheral vision. Charlie sets my glass down and stares placidly at him. The cop watches us for a while, then scans the room with narrowed eyes. Charlie's face is blank as a wall, and I do my best to drool. Finally, the cop tips his cap. Thank you, gentlemen. If you see or hear anything, please let us know right away. This old guy is in no shape to be out on his own. I surely will, says Charlie. Feel free to have a look around the lot. I'll have my guys keep an eye out for him. It would be a terrible shame if something happened to him. Here's my number, says the cop, handing Charlie a card. Give me a call if you hear anything. You bet. The cop takes one final look around and then steps toward the door. Well, good night, then, he says. Good night, says Charlie, following him to the door. After he shuts it, he comes back to the table. He sits and pours us each another whiskey. We each take a sip and then sit in silence. Are you sure about this? He finally asks. Yep. What about your health? You need any medicine? No, there's nothing wrong with me but old age, and I reckon that will take care of itself eventually. What about your family? I take another sip of whiskey, swirl the remaining liquid around the bottom, and then drain the glass. I'll send them postcards. I look at his face and realize that didn't come out right. I didn't mean it like that. I love them and I know they love me, but I'm no longer really a part of their lives. I'm more like a duty. That's why I had to find my own way over here tonight. They plumb forgot about me. Charlie's brow is furrowed. He looks dubious. I barrel on, desperate. I'm 93. What have I got to lose? I can still mostly take care of myself. I'll need some help for some things, but nothing like what you're thinking. I feel my eyes grow moist and try to rearrange my ruined face into some semblance of toughness. I'm no wimp, by God. Let me come along. I can sell tickets. Russ can do anything. He's young. Give me his job. I can still count. And I don't shortchange. I know you don't run a grift show. Charlie's eyes mist over. I swear to God they do. I continue on a roll. If they catch up with me, they catch up with me. If they don't, well, then at end of season, I'll call and go back. And if something goes wrong in the meantime, just call and they'll come get me. What's the harm in that? Charlie stares at me. I've never seen a man look more serious. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. He's not going to answer. 7, 8, 9. He's going to send me back there, and why shouldn't he? He doesn't know me from Adam. 10, 11, 12. All right, he says. All right! All right. Let's give you something to tell your grandkids about. Or great-grandkids. Or great-great-grandkids. I snort with glee, delirious with excitement. Charlie winks and pours me another finger's worth of whiskey. Then on second thought, he tips the bottle again. I reach out and grab its neck. Better not, I say. Don't want to get tipsy and break a hip. And then I laugh, because it's so ridiculous and so gorgeous, and it's all I can do not to melt into a fit of giggles. So what if I'm 93? So what if I'm ancient and cranky, and my body's a wreck? If they're willing to accept me and my guilty conscience, why the hell shouldn't I run away with the circus? It's like Charlie told a cop. For this old man, this is home.
Highbridge Audio brings you the best new fiction from established and up-and-coming authors. See what's new at www.highbridgeaudio.com. Now, listen as Jenna Lamia reads an excerpt from Firefly Cloak, the latest release from Oprah Book Club author Sherry Reynolds. Highbridge Audio presents Firefly Cloak by Sherry Reynolds. Read for you by Jenna Lamia.
The night before she lost her mama, Tessa Lee camped out in a two-room tent with her mama, her little brother Travis, and a crooked-nosed man named Goose. Goose had picked them up that morning at a grocery store in South Hibiscus and loaded their bags into the back of his pickup while her mama gave Tessa Lee a shove into the cab. When Travis was settled beside her and when her mama had rooted in and slammed the door, Goose said, "Let's skedaddle," and they rattled through the parking lot, waving goodbye to the old men who sat out front on benches and waited for the ice cream truck. It was the first time Tessa Lee had ever heard that word, skedaddle, and she sang it over and over to a tune she made up herself. She sang it to Travis and grabbed at his pudding belly and made him laugh until her mama told her to quit. "Shame bothering me," Goose said, but Tessa Lee shut up anyway. She couldn't stop singing it in her head, though. As they bumped their way out of town, Tessa Lee studied the rearview mirror and the dusty ghosts poofing up behind them. "Skedaddle, skedaddle," she mouthed to the ghosts. They left behind her bicycle and her Weebles, her Spirograph and her books. Her mama had said she wouldn't need toys while she was on vacation, but as they drove along hot roads that faded into wavy black seas, it seemed strange to Tessa Lee that she'd be going on vacation with a man she'd never met before. He was friendly enough and let her steer for a long time in Alabama, but while Travis was steering, she turned around and saw that the wind had blown over a bag of her clothes. Her winter coat had spilled out, and the furry hood shivered like a kitten against the tailgate. Tessa Lee shivered too, in spite of the thick heat, and said to her mama, "Must be going on vacation in the North Pole if I'm gonna need my fur coat when I get there." And Tessa Lee's mama shook her head and lit another smoke.
"Smart girl," Goose said. "If she's smart, she'll quit sassing," her mama replied.
But Tessa Lee could tell she wasn't mad, just worried. She could see worry in the way her mama tapped that cigarette at the edge of the windowsill, trying to keep the ashes neat and short and manageable. Not a bit like laid-back Goose, who let his ashes grow long and fade to white, then drop down warm onto his hairy belly. Goose listened to country and sang with all the yodelers and told stories about going on alligator hunts when he was a boy. After a while, Travis fell asleep, and when they stopped for gas somewhere in Tennessee, Tessa Lee's mama was left holding him, while Tessa Lee went in the store to help Goose tote out the yoo-hoos. When the man behind the counter said, "Your little girl's gonna be a heartbreaker," Goose said, "Already is," and winked at Tessa Lee, and she trotted out proud with the drinks and decided it wouldn't be so bad to have a daddy named after a bird. "Gotta gear down," Goose said as they went up a hill, and by then they were in the mountains and gearing down a lot. Tessa Lee adjusted her legs so that he could work the gear shift. The backs of her thighs sweated against the vinyl seat, and when she tried to move them, a little bit of her skin got pinched in a place where the seat had cracked and the foam poked through. Goose jiggled gears against the insides of her knees, and Tessa Lee looked at her mama, who took tiny, quiet gasps of air and twiddled her fingers through Travis's curls until his head looked like 100 black fins. They stopped again at a truck stop off a busy highway, a bright yellow building where they sold ponchos and fireworks and bumper stickers that Tessa Lee wasn't allowed to read. Her mama yanked her away from the stickers and paid for their bags of barbecue potato chips, along with some handy wipes for the truck. When they got back out, Goose had moved the truck to the rear of the building, behind three big metal dumpsters that sat there like a row of rhinoceroses, minus their horns. He was changing the license plates.
"What do we need new license plates for?" Tessa Lee asked.
"Shh," he said, then whispered, "We're in a new state. Gotta have new plates." Then he looked at her mama and said, "Load 'em up, Sheila."
"Come on,"
her mama said, but Tessa Lee was already hunched down next to Goose.
"These plates aren't new," she said.
"Sure they are,"
Goose answered, looking over his shoulder, then giving all four screws another quick twist.
"They're new to us. Hop on in the truck now. We gotta scoot."
So Tessa Lee climbed inside, and soon they were on the road, the red line of the speedometer climbing up to the middle, then pointing all the way to her mama's bony knees.
Water for Elephants was produced and directed by Paul Rubin. This has been a Highbridge Audio presentation.